Do you ever wonder where all your money went? Like every single time you look at your bank account? Honestly, it's probably all those subscriptions. I felt that way too, until I got Rocket Money. Rocket Money helped me see all the subscriptions I'm paying for, and it was eye-opening. Between streaming services, fitness apps, delivery services, it all adds up so quickly. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year, with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
Looking for a new high-end mascara without breaking the bank? The new L'Oreal Paris Panorama Mascara gives you a high-end lash look in a premium gold luxe packaging. It's all about panoramic volume and fully fanned out lashes. With its tapered brush, the new Panorama Mascara catches every single lash, giving you the false lash look without any of the hassle. Say goodbye to clumps and flakes, because this mascara is specially formulated to resist them all day with up to 24-hour wear. And the best part? It performs better than luxe mascaras at only a fraction of the cost. You can buy Panorama Mascara on Amazon today.
From 30 Rockefeller Plaza in New York City, please enjoy this podcast edition of Late Night with Seth Meyers. On today's show, Seth chats with CNN's Jake Tapper. Then, exclusively for this podcast, Tapper goes backstage at Studio AG to answer a few more questions. But first, a closer look.
President Trump has now moved on from trying to discredit the Russia investigation to pretending it's over while lawmakers in both parties try to work with Trump on an immigration deal. For more on this, it's time for a closer look. There are reports that Special Counsel Robert Mueller's rapidly escalating Russia investigation is now nearing the point where Mueller may want to interview Trump in the next few weeks. And yet, despite those developments, Trump is doing everything he can to pretend the investigation doesn't exist and that the allegations of Russian collusion are not real, as he did at Camp David on Saturday.
There's been no collusion. There's been no crime. And in theory, everybody tells me I'm not under investigation. Maybe Hillary is, I don't know, but I'm not. But there's been no collusion. There's been no crime. But we have been very open. We could have done it two ways. We could have been very closed, and it would have taken years. But, you know, it's sort of like when you've done nothing wrong, let's be open and get it over with. Because, honestly, it's very, very bad for our country. It's making our country look foolish.
That's not what's making our country look foolish. Trump's like the kid at the sleepover who wakes up with a penis drawn on his face and doesn't know that's why everyone's laughing. What's so funny? Is it Kevin's asthma? How hilarious is it that he needs an inhaler? Hey, do you guys smell Sharpie? Now, Republicans have repeatedly tried to discredit the Russia investigation by falsely claiming that it resulted from the Christopher Steele dossier, which contains some salacious and unverified rumors about Trump, as well as some information that has been corroborated by the FBI. Trump himself has attacked the dossier, like when he tweeted about a Fox & Friends segment the day after Christmas. Wow, Fox & Friends dossier is bogus. Clinton campaign, DNC-funded dossier. FBI cannot, after all this time, verify claims in dossier of Russia-Trump collusion. FBI tainted. And they use this crooked Hillary pile of garbage as the basis for going after the Trump campaign. That's all one tweet. Hey, Twitter, you couldn't wait until the next president to go to 280 characters? That's like saying, hey, that guy's got a gun. Give him another gun. Also, I love how he starts with, wow, Fox and Friends, like he's shocked that they confirmed his suspicions. It's kind of like M. Night Shyamalan turning to you at the end of The Sixth Sense and going, wow, Bruce Willis was dead the whole time. And what's with the all caps? Is he even writing his tweets anymore or screaming them at an Amazon Echo? Alexa, are you okay?
Please kill me.
But in fact, we learned again this week that the dossier was not the initial basis for the Russia investigation. Glenn Simpson, the co-founder of the firm that contracted Steele to put the dossier together, testified behind closed doors to Congress that the FBI already had intelligence that tipped them to allegations of possible collusion between the Trump campaign and Russia. Now, the only reason we know about this testimony is because Democratic Senator Dianne Feinstein decided to release it to counter Republican claims that the dossier was the reason for the Russia investigation, and Trump did not react to that well. He took to Twitter to call her sneaky Dianne Feinstein. I gotta say, that's a pretty lame insult coming from the guy who coined Lil Marco and Lion Ted. If anything, sneaky makes her sound cool. What's next, Wild Warren or Balls Out Bernie? Now, Trump's Twitter outbursts only add to the growing impression that the president is dangerously unfit for the job, an impression Trump tried to counter on Tuesday by televising his immigration negotiations with Democrats. During that meeting, Trump was asked about his position on DACA, the program that protects undocumented immigrants brought here as children, and seemed to not really have one.
It seems to me not much has actually changed here in terms of your positions at this particular
meeting. No, I think it's changed. I think my positions are going to be what the people in this room come up with. I am very much reliant on the people in this room. If they come to me with things that I'm not in love with, I'm going to do it.
Trump treats governing like he's at his first sushi restaurant with his Japanese friend.
I don't know what any of this means, so just tell me what to get. But no, I like hamburgers.
In fact, Trump is so addled and confused about policy that during this meeting, he seemed to agree with whoever was talking at any given moment. For example, Democrats want a clean renewal of the DACA program without any attachments. Republicans want funding for the border wall included as any part of any deal. Trump has claimed to also want that, yet during the meeting, he seemed to go back and forth depending on who was talking.
What about a clean DACA bill now, with a commitment that we go into a comprehensive immigration reform procedure?
I have no problem. I think that's basically what Dick is saying. We're going to come out with DACA. We're going to do DACA. And then we can start immediately on the phase two, which would be comprehensive.
Would you be agreeable to that?
Yeah, I would like to do that.
Mr. President, you need to be clear, though. I think what Senator Feinstein's asking here, mm-hmm. when we talk about just DACA, we don't want to be back here 2 years later. You have to have security, as the secretary would tell you.
But I think that's what she's saying.
I think she's saying something different.
I think what we're all saying is we'll do DACA, and we can certainly start comprehensive immigration reform the following afternoon.
Oh, my God. It's like watching siblings try to get their senile grandfather to write them into his will. I should get all the money. Okay, that seems right. Why should he get all the money? No, that wouldn't be fair. Our president is Elmer Fudd trying to decide if it's duck season or rabbit season.
Okay, but the rabbit makes a good point when he says it's actually duck season. What's that? Oh, hold on. The duck's telling me something completely different.
So we have a bewildered president who has no idea what he's talking about, ping-ponging from one position to the next, depending on who's speaking. How did the media react? Well, apparently, the bar is now so low for Trump that making it through one meeting is considered a win.
This is the presidency that many people thought Donald Trump was capable of. Just the notion of him being in command, of him wanting the cameras in there and wanting the cameras to see him sitting at a table with Democrats and Republicans, playing the role of a deal maker.
He held a meeting that was televised with both sides of the aisle. No hate speak, no faux populism.
The president there at times appearing quite engaged, asking questions, calling on congressional leaders, offering solutions.
He was conscious. He knew where he was. He didn't scream obscenities. He never peed his pants. News anchors talk about Trump the way you talk about a sick cat. He was awake. He was drinking water. He let Mike Pence pet him. Of course, those glowing reviews were not lost on Trump, who bragged about them yesterday in a rambling aside during a cabinet meeting, where he claimed that news anchors had sent him letters of congratulations for his performance during the meeting.
It was a tremendous meeting. Actually, it was reported as incredibly good. And my performance, some of them called it a performance. I consider it work. But got great reviews by everybody other than two networks who were phenomenal for about 2 hours. Then after that, they were called by their bosses and said, oh, wait a minute. And unfortunately, a lot of those anchors sent us letters saying that was one of the greatest meetings they've ever witnessed. And they were great. For about 2 hours, they were phenomenal.
And then they went a little bit south on us, but not that bad. It was fine. They probably wished they didn't send us those letters of congratulations, but it was good.
A letter of congratulations? I doubt that happened, but if you get a letter congratulating you for getting through a one-hour meeting, the proper response is to be embarrassed. So...
Can you see this? I got this letter for not tripping on my way in the room.
So lawmakers are working to get an immigration deal, and they said today they'd reached one. And yet Trump apparently decided to inject some vulgar racism into the conversation. Just before we started taping tonight, the Washington Post reported that President Trump grew frustrated with lawmakers Thursday in the Oval Office when they floated restoring protections from immigrants from Haiti, El Salvador, and African countries as part of a bipartisan immigration deal. Trump said, "Why are we having all these people from whole countries come here?" To be fair, maybe he meant it as a compliment. After all, Trump does all his best tweets when he's sitting on the hole. So we have a president whose administration is under a cloud of scandal and who's so addled he doesn't know at any given time what his own positions are. Basically, the national mood right now can be summed up with three words.
Please kill me.
This has been A Closer Look.
Ryan Reese, audience warrant comedian for Late Night with Seth Meyers, here with Bill, who just came from a live taping. We're now officially into 2018. What would you like to see happen in this new year?
That's a very general question. My specific answer would be to have a Democratic movement happen so that we will have a candidate we can kind of imagine for 2020.
President Trump seems to say that he's a genius a lot. Do you agree?
A genius in what way? He manipulated the whole campaign that he served on. And I think that, in a sense, is a sort of genius, but it's not the kind that we mostly respect.
You said for the new year you wanted to see a Democratic movement and a candidate we can get behind. Is there anyone you have in mind or any specific ideals you're looking for in such a candidate?
Although he's very young, I think that Joseph Kennedy, who is now in the House of Representatives from Massachusetts, might be a good person to begin pointing the finger at likely candidates. And then, of course, there's Bernie, but no offense, he may even be older than Trump. So I would like to have somebody younger than 40, younger than 50, kind of move this around.
All right. Terrific, Bill. Thanks for joining us.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Our guest tonight is CNN's chief Washington correspondent. He hosts The Lead weekday afternoons on CNN, as well as the network Sunday show, State of the Union. Please welcome back to the show our very good friend, Jake Tapper, everyone. How are you?
I'm good. I'd love a band. How come news people don't get banned?
You never get a band.
No, the music
you
I
get
have.
A better. You have a nice opening graphic package, though.
I know, but it's not. I don't have any like that. They're cool.
Yeah, but you had something better than a band this week. You had Stephen Miller on your show,
and not the Stephen Miller band.
No, that's true. Yeah, he's like attacks like an eagle. So, thank you. So a few of you. Yeah,
that's good. Come on.
I mean, you know, it was a group effort. It was a group effort. So Stephen Miller was on your show on Sunday, and he came out guns blazing. I want to show, for those who missed it, and I feel bad for anyone who missed it, but let's just show a bit of a supercut of the highlights of your interview with Stephen Miller, and then I have some questions.
Okay. Why don't you just give me 3 minutes to tell you the truth about Donald Trump that I know, and then all of our campaigns
because
staff know?
Because it's my show, and I don't want to do that. So
this isn't a courtroom, and I have a right to speak.
Settle down. Calm down.
Jake.
I have a question for you about issues.
I would be with the president on a campaign plane with a rally in 20 minutes, and he would be
You've
able
already
to
made
come
this
up
point, Stephen.
A self-made billionaire, revolutionized reality TV, and tap into something magical that's happening in the hearts of this country. The people that
the
you
president
don't
has approval
people,
rating in the 30s. I don't know what
people,
magical you're talking
people,
about. There's one viewer that you care about right now, and you're being obsequious.
No,
you're being
which,
a factotum
no,
in order
being,
to please him. Okay.
No.
And I think
you know,
I've
you know
wasted. I think I've wasted enough of my
you
viewers'
know
time.
You know who
Thank
I care
Stephen.
About?
As Republicans, hey, lawmakers call for Attorney General Jeff Sessions to resign.
So I have to ask. You know Stephen Miller. You've interacted with him before. Did that catch you off guard, the tone of that interview?
Yeah, I've known him for a long time. He was a press secretary on Capitol Hill for quite some time. I knew that he was sometimes unusual to interact with.
Mm-hmm.
But no, I was not expecting that. I was not...
I would not have booked him if I thought that that was what was going
to
happen.
Does it feel at some point a little bit like a rodeo and you're just trying to stay on top of the interview with that?
It was just so... Most of the time when people come and they want to represent their point of view, and I've interviewed President Trump, I've interviewed Rex Tillerson, we've interviewed lots of people. Most of the time when they want to get across their point of view, even if they think you're being unfair or they don't like the questions, there's an effort made to have a certain behavior like a human being.
Yeah. Which makes sense, because you're a human.
I'm
humans
a human
are
being.
Watching.
Yeah.
Yeah.
My viewers are 90% human.
Yeah.
10% cats. And there's also usually in politics an effort to be likable, to convince people. And I certainly understand the White House point of view that the media is unfair to them and doesn't give them their due and all of that. It wasn't a conversation where he wasn't allowing me to ask questions. He wasn't answering my questions. He started repeating himself. It was just bizarre.
He was complaining that you weren't giving him time to talk about issues, and yet every time you tried to cede time, it seemed like he went back to things he'd already said.
Yeah.
Do you feel like...
Like the story about the president coming up with riffing off the news.
Yeah.
If you missed it at 9:01, he told it again at 9:07.
You said, had you known it would go like that, you wouldn't have had him on.
Yeah.
You must have this balance that I'm sure people ask you about this all the time, like, who you allow on your show. And there are people with certain hateful rhetoric who are now in the White House.
Right.
And so how do you decide, as far as just being a gatekeeper as to guests,
yeah.
You obviously have a lot of Trump people on your show. Do you think that's important?
Well, he's the president, and the Republicans control the House and the Senate and the White House. So I think it is very important to ask them questions and to speak truth to power and also just to get information from them and have them explain what they're doing. The way it works normally is you have a Sunday show or even a weekday show, and you ask the White House, we would like this guest or we would like that guest. And on Sunday, it's really just who are you putting out this Sunday?
Mm-hmm.
This is how it was during Clinton, Bush, Obama, Trump. And they tell you who they're offering. That Sunday, you know, they were offering Nikki Haley and CIA Director Pompeo and Stephen Miller. And I wanted Nikki Haley or CIA Director Pompeo.
Yeah.
But we got Miller. And look, I'm happy. He was. The big news was the Michael Wolff book.
Yeah.
Which the White House cooperated with. Otherwise, I don't think it would get a quarter as much attention.
Mm-hmm.
The falling out between President Trump and Steve Bannon. And Steve Bannon was responsible for getting Stephen Miller on the campaign. They did used to work closely together. And immigration. Those were three big issues. And Stephen Miller, you know, could talk to all three of them. So we booked him.
He called Steve Bannon grotesque a few times during your interview. He came back to that point. Steve Bannon obviously has fallen out of favor with the White House, and the knives are out for him, despite the fact that he was a guy who also seemed to have knives out quite a bit. Do you have any empathy for the sort of fallen members of the Trump administration once they sort of fall out and they're sort of ravaged by their once colleagues?
I wouldn't call it empathy, but, I mean, the truth of the matter is Steve Bannon played a huge role in the final months of the Trump campaign and in the first... whatever it was, 8 months of the Trump presidency. And to pretend that he didn't was silly. And when President Trump issued the statement, and this is really where the conversation with Stephen Miller started to go off the rails, is when I started to ask about the fact that the president had said Bannon didn't play a role. And I said, well, what about all these issues? I was defending Steve Bannon, which is one of the reasons why his attack on me and CNN subsequent, like, you know, we're liberal media, we're biased, I was defending Steve Bannon.
Yeah.
That's
you
liberal.
Lefty. you bleeding heart lefty. You did say he was talking to an audience of one, and very quickly after Donald Trump tweeted, brought truth to the statement and said, Jake Tapper of Fake News just got destroyed. This interview with Stephen Miller of the Trump administration. Watch the hatred and unfairness of the CNN flunky. I'm sorry about that. But then you wrote back.
I said factotum. That's a word.
You wrote back with an emoji. Here's the interview. Judge for yourself. So you certainly, your feelings weren't hurt that much. You were here last 4 months ago.
Yeah.
You've been here.
Only 4 months.
It's only 4 months. But you've been here a fair amount throughout the Trump presidency. We're now coming up on a year. Are you, it's felt longer than a year, but based on where we are now and where we were a year ago, is this what you expected? And is there anything that you didn't expect?
Every day that has happened in the last year, I didn't expect. I think I expected in your monologue or closer look, you talked about the 55 minutes of Trump negotiating immigration. However, he obviously not well-versed on every issue, but in there and, breathing. I think I expected more of that and less of the just bedlam and chaos that has really marked the year.
You mentioned the Michael Wolff book and the anger that's coming out of the Trump White House about it. You think to some degree that speaks to the vanity of the Trump White House?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think Michael Wolff very clearly, and I think he's been pretty open about it. Early on, he wrote a vaguely flattering piece about President Trump, more than it being flattering. It had a nice picture on the cover of The Hollywood Reporter.
It was a nice picture.
It was a very nice picture, and he apparently really liked it.
Yeah.
And then
he likes ones with more pictures.
and then he did an early interview with Steve Bannon that was offensively just handing him the microphone and talking. Mm. At a time when I think a lot of people were really worried about Steve Bannon and what ideas he was going to bring in. But it was all what's called in my business beat sweetening. He was sweetening the beat. He was gaining their trust, and they fell for it. And look, this is a guy who has a reputation for doing this and making a lot of money and being very successful doing it, flattering his way into a story, doing his particular kind of journalism, and leaving a lot of crying people behind him.
You know, Bannon gets a lot of credit for being sort of a crazy genius who figured out all these things and yet makes a mistake like this. Is it just more likely that there was not a lot of genius going on?
Well, I don't think I've ever called him a creative genius.
Yeah.
But I think that first of all, I wasn't there for a lot of it or for any of it, really. But I think that certain journalists, when they say something's off the record, they really mean it. They think it's, you know, you can honor it. And certain journalists, it doesn't mean anything to them. Mm-hmm. And they're happy to burn sources and run away from the story. And run away after the story is done. And it seems as though he did that a bunch of times. So, I mean, I don't... You know, Bannon's not denying that he said these things in the book. And I can't believe he would have said them thinking they were going to be in the book.
Right. It is pretty crazy. And the interesting thing is there is a parallel because I feel as though Donald Trump sort of burned a lot of people on his way to the White House. And then I think he'd be justified by saying, I got to the White House. Whereas Michael Wolff did the same. And I think he would justify it by being, I'm the number one book on Amazon.
There is a poetic justice to it.
Yeah.
That this is the book so far that defines the Trump presidency with somebody who has just upended all standards. And yet, we in the media, journalists, are supposed to uphold standards.
Yeah.
We're not supposed to lower them just according to... I mean, you know, if I responded to... This is the world we're in. If I responded to President Trump the way that he writes about journalists, I mean, calling me a flunky or whatever, you would be like, oh... I can't believe Jake did that.
Yeah.
You would be disappointed.
Glad you hold the standard up.
You'd be like, well, I wish he hadn't done that. I wish Jake hadn't done that. The president did it. The president did it. You know, but we are expected to uphold these standards. So, I mean, that's why I'm not, you know, reading the book on air as gospel. We have to be skeptical about it.
The real standard in your family, no offense to you, your daughter, last October, got an op-ed published in the New York Times.
She's 10.
She's 10.
Yeah.
But this is true that she got an op-ed, and it's called... And by the way, she did not hide that she was 10. The op-ed title is, I'm 10. And I want girls to raise their hand. And this is a true story. Your daughter came up with her own Girl Scout badge.
My kids are amazing. Jack, who's 8, and Alice, who's 10. And Alice came home from school and said, the girls don't raise their hands. The boys raise their hands. And she talked about it with my wife, her mom, and she talked about it with her Girl Scout troop. And they came up with this badge to encourage girls to raise their hands. You have to pledge to do it and get 3 other girls to do it. She came up with the badge, and when the badge came out, I was very proud, and I put it out there. It was also right in the middle of the Me Too movement, and It seemed like it's great. Because she wasn't blaming anybody for anything. She was saying, we need to be in charge of this.
Yep.
And then I tweeted it, and somebody from the New York Times, a nice woman named Barry Weiss, reached out and said, would your daughter want to write an op-ed for us? And she did it. And honestly, these kids, like, she's like, oh, that's cool. She doesn't know.
Yeah. Have you ever been asked to write an op-ed in the New York Times?
I've had a few in there, but never... It's more like I've begged to get them in. Yeah. I've never been solicited.
Right, right. Well,
actually, that's not true. They asked me to write something, and then they killed it.
Really?
Yeah.
Did she ever go over and be like, hey, Dad, that's all right. Sometimes you win, sometimes you lose. Well, you have an incredible family. I'm always happy to see them as well. And thank you so much for being here. It's always such a pleasure. Thanks for having everybody. The Leaders, weekdays at 4 p.m. State of the Union here, Sundays at 9 a.m. I'll see you then.
Hi, everyone. It's Sarah from Late Night. I'm backstage with Jake Tapper.
Hi, Sarah.
Hi, Jake. Jake, you have the prestigious honor of being our most frequent podcast now. This is your third appearance.
It's been a goal that I set in college, and now I've achieved it. I'm the third, you know, and I'm in 30 Rock, so I assume there will be something like when people are in SNL 15 times, 10 times, like there's going to be like a little skit. Like
yep.
Steve Martin's about to burst out, Tom Hanks.
Yeah, it's a surprise, but, yeah. You know. We'll get there.
Okay.
I wanted to talk about Fire and Fury, the book that came out that you discussed.
Yeah.
It was a point of contention in your interview with Stephen Miller.
One of many points of contention.
What sort of was your response from a journalistic point of view after reading the book and your thoughts on how it all came together and how people responded to it?
Well, I mean, I'll start off with the positive.
Okay.
You want to give Michael Wolff credit for, he got an unbelievable amount of access to the White House. And this is not a White House it's easy to get access to for journalists, unless you're very, very friendly media like Fox or Breitbart. So you give him credit for that. Mm-hmm. He sold them and he got in. And then he got a bunch of quotes, most of which, in terms of like the most damning ones, have not been disputed from Steve Bannon and others. I guess Roger Ailes can't really... dispute anything that he's passed, but mm-hmm. you know, so you give him that. That said, a lot of the book is kind of just like regurgitated reporting from CNN, The Washington Post, The New York Times, Wall Street Journal, others, you know, in terms of the president's TV viewing habits, his attention span, his depth of policy knowledge, etc. And then I think that there's just like some sketchy stuff that Michael Wolff has been known to do, and it's been written about like more than a decade ago, mm-hmm. About how, you know, things that are off the record or on the record, that he kind of like conflates scenes. Like, you know, let's say if you told me that Seth said something and then I just assume I didn't even ask Seth, I just went with it.
Yeah,
especially if it was controversial. I mean, that's not journalism.
Right.
I mean, it's not the best way to do journalism anyway.
What precipitated this response from Trump, where he denounced Bannon so heavily, were these comments in the book. Do you think that when the Mercers pushed him out of Breitbart, and do you think that that started because of his comments in the book, or do you think that there was more of like a slippery slope, like maybe backing Roy Moore or some other things that he's done since he's left the White House?
It's tough to know, because obviously the president is such a creature of impulse, and his response to the book and to Steve Bannon has been so impulsive and mm-hmm. so not the way you deal with a crisis. I mean, the way you deal with a crisis is you say, you don't say anything yourself about it. You have right. a press person say, that book is gossip and people have disputed the quotes. I'm not dignifying it with a response, and you move on. But, you know, that wasn't how they handled it. They handled it. They threatened a lawsuit to block publication of the book,
right.
which is preposterous. I mean, it's really ludicrous. I don't know, is the short answer, you know, but obviously he and Steve Bannon had, you know, they've been having problems. He left, you know, he kicked him out of the White House, and there was the whole Roy Moore thing. But I think it was, honestly, at the end of the day, I don't even think it was insulting Donald Trump Jr. or calling Ivanka dumb as a brick. I think this Russia thing, the president really, really hates it.
Mm-hmm.
And he gave credibility to it. Bannon called that meeting treasonous and unpatriotic,
right.
And said that the odds that Don Jr. didn't march those guests to President Trump's office is zero. I mean, he gave credibility to it, and that is the thing that President Trump seems to hate the most.
Yeah. Something a little bit more personal about you. You've talked about this on the show. You collect campaign posters.
I collect, just to be precise, okay. I collect the campaign posters of losing presidential candidates.
So it's only presidential candidates.
I do have a Roy Moore poster. Okay, but I didn't collect it. Somebody gave it to me. But yes, losing presidential candidates, and it can include like a re-elect Carter poster.
Okay.
But not elect Carter. I don't have elect Carter. I have re-elect Carter.
Now that this has become something that people know about you, do people, like Roy Moore, that was sent to you, do people give these to you as gifts?
CNN people, send me stuff. Somebody brought me the Roy Moore poster. Do you want it? I'm like, I guess that doesn't really fit. It doesn't really, but sure. I mean, it was notorious enough. The truth of the matter is I've run out of wall space. And I don't know what I'm supposed to do anymore. I'm kind of like at odds because I have this great collection, and literally I don't have any. Like I just got this. You know, they used to have handkerchiefs. It wasn't posters. They would do handkerchiefs. So I have like a
for people to wear.
Yeah, or wave, I guess. Huh. So I have a Grover Cleveland and Benjamin Harrison.
We're going way back. Okay.
Handkerchief collection, yes, and it's framed, and I don't have any space for it. It's just sitting in my office.
Is there one that you really want that you don't have?
Well. I don't have people used to not campaign, right? I mean, you remember from when you saw Hamilton and you learned that Aaron Burr was the first one to campaign.
Right.
Like, so, I mean, the poster, like the first, you know, several elections, there weren't posters, at least not that I know of. I would really like a John Breckinridge. John Breckinridge in 1860 was the Democrat that...
He lost to Lincoln?
He lost to Lincoln.
Okay.
Yeah, but he was one. There were like four candidates. There was Stephen Douglas,
yep.
And Lincoln, and John Breckinridge, and then some other. I forgot who the fourth one was. And I can't find one anywhere.
But you know it exists.
No, I don't.
Oh, okay.
I don't. I imagine it exists. I bought some little buttons with John Breckinridge's picture on it from his campaign, but it's just not good enough for me.
Well, maybe that's the surprise gift for being the most frequent podcast guest.
A John Breckinridge
when
poster?
When you come back for the fourth time, that's what
just don't
get.
Bring me the poster of James Buchanan with John Breckinridge as his running mate, because that's not the same thing.
Okay.
Thank you.
I'll let the gift people know. Well, thanks so much for being here, Jake.
Oh, sure. It's great, Sarah. Thanks for having me.
Want more Late Night with Seth Meyers? Be sure to follow the handle @LateNightSeth on Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, Instagram, and Snapchat. You can also watch full episodes of Late Night at LateNightSeth.com or on the NBC app. And please tell your friends who are fans of Seth Meyers to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes.
I feel like I was blindsided.
Because it's a competition show.
From the producers of Jury Duty and The Bachelor.
We have scoured the earth for the 14 greatest reality contestants that were available during our production window.
Comes a reality competition show about reality competition shows.
Nobody has dared to find out who is the actual best at just being on a reality show. I'm your host, comedian Daniel Tosh.
It's win or go home.
Each episode, our contestants will face new challenges that will test their strength and lack of life skills for a chance to win $200
million.
$200,000.
Prepare, because it's about to be ugly, crying, lots of fighting.
Tayshia, I have to defend myself.
Celebrating 25 years of reality TV with your favorites.
I have diarrhea. You cannot do this to me.
What in gay hell have I got myself into?
The GOAT, premiering on Freevee and Prime Video on May 9th.